When we concluded the episode last week, part one, with Chris Struth, I kind of left you hanging. That is, if you listened to it, and I will tell you right now, if you didn't get a chance to listen to that episode before you start this one, you really need to go back and listen to part one with Chris Struth. We talk about losing your faith, deconstructing your former beliefs. At least in this case, in Chris's case, it was in evangelical Christianity. And that's exactly why I titled these episodes with Chris Stroop, A Long and Winding Road. It really is a long and winding road. If you're a person like myself, like Chris Stroop, and especially listening to his story, is quite a heartbreaking one in a way, because through all of his journeying and all of his questions and doubts and crisis of faith, he was all alone, or at least he believed himself to be all alone. And I think that's a very common thing. And I hear that a lot from ex-evangelicals all the time, both on Twitter and on the ex-evangelical Facebook page, that we feel like we're the only ones going through this stuff. And we start to wonder if we're going crazy and having all these questions and doubts, certainly walking away from the church. Because as we all know, or you should know hopefully by now, that religion, certainly Christianity, is a very all-pervasive thing. And it affects every area of our life, and it forms our very identity. That is, if you came into it even as an adult, or like me, if you were raised in the church, every single area of our lives was somehow affected, filtered through the lens of what does God have to say about this? What does the Bible have to say? Every decision, everything that we did, whatever job we took, where you may have thought you wanted to move somewhere in the world, any decision that you made had to be filtered through this lens of what does God have to say about it? What does the Bible have to say? And so everything is affected by our religion. And it's, as I say, it's our very identity. So disentangling yourself from that, as Chris said, it's a long and winding road. It's a long, laborious, and painful process. And it will probably take the rest of your life. You can't just disentangle yourself from it in 5 minutes. Now, in today's episode, Chris and I are going to finish up talking about what happened when he came home from this missionary trip to Russia, his second trip, even though he was having questions and doubts about his faith, and then what happened when he comes home. And we're going to let him tell you what was the result of his deconstruction and his finally putting a stake in the ground and saying, I am no longer an evangelical. What was the reaction of his parents and his family? And this is a very scary step to make. As he said last week, I didn't want to pay the social cost of losing all those relationships by declaring that I no longer believe in all this stuff anymore. And it can be a very high social cost. You can lose everything. In my case, I spent virtually all of my adult life either in academics, education, pastoring a church, teaching in a Bible college, and all of that stuff. I think, I don't know if it was a waste of time. It certainly made me the person that I am now, but I think I could have been doing a lot of other things. And I've kind of burned a lot of bridges. And by taking a stand, doing things like this podcast and the things that I write and the things that I post on Facebook and Twitter, they've kind of said, this is where I'm at and this is who I am now. And I'm unapologetic about it. And so hopefully that'll help you by talking to people like Chris Stroop and all the other people that I've talked to on this show and that are coming up in the next few weeks and months. That will help you to deconstruct your own belief system, or at least understand how you've been affected by religion. Because the simple fact is, no matter where you live in the world, somehow your life, your worldview has been impacted by someone else, and it's usually some sort of religious context. So there's a long history there of Christianity and other religions that have impacted the way we live our lives and the way we view the world. And so these are things that Chris Stroop and I are going to be getting into in this episode. One of the particular passions that Chris has is sort of looking at things from an academic point of view and really tracing the historical movements of things like Christian fundamentalism, the religious right, how we arrived at where we are today in terms of certainly the American scene, the incredible connection between religion and politics that is unique really in America. You don't really see that in many other places around the world. In fact, we just came back from a trip to France and Belgium, and I was talking to some of the Belgian people there that I met, and they were saying that from their point of view, religion. Okay, Belgium is supposed to be a Catholic country, but people are just going through the motions. The churches are basically empty. They're like museum showpieces, and it's really not a factor in most people's lives. It's just a part of the culture there, and you see that in places like France as well. So it's very different in America. It's very, very different. So talking to a person like Chris can be very helpful because it can kind of help you to understand, again, that historical context, how things have developed and where we are today and what you as a person can do about it from a critical sort of thinking your way through it point of view. So hopefully the second half of our conversation today will be helpful to you in processing some of this stuff through. Now, I will say, for Patreon supporters of this show, if you want to hear more of me talking to Chris, there is a bonus episode of about a half an hour that I recorded. It's sort of a pre-recording conversation between myself and Chris, and that is available for Patreon supporters of this show kind of as a bonus. You can support this show, and the links to that are in the show notes for even as little as a dollar a month. You can also contact myself on Twitter at MindShift2018, and I will have links for you to follow Chris on Twitter as well, where he is very active, as well as links to his blog, so you can check out some of his articles, as well as some of the other things he's written in other publications. So I invite you to come along with me and Chris Stroup as we embark down that long and winding road, and let's help you to deconstruct your faith just a little bit as well.
I still didn't want to talk about that. I didn't know how to. I didn't want to rock the boat with my family. So for a long time, I kind of dissimulated, quasi-dissimulated, or just didn't talk about certain things, or just go along to get along.
Right. So you were kind of disguising your true thoughts, your true feelings, just sort of going through the motions.
Then I went and taught English in Russia for a year after I graduated from college, back in the same region, actually, where I knew many of the people that were involved in the summer camps that I went to as a short-term missionary. And just kind of continued thinking about things, processing mostly on my own. Very afraid of hell, though I'd basically stopped believing in it.
Okay, so I'm just trying to piece together your story so far. Basically, you grew up in evangelicalism. You went to Christian high school. You had kind of a crisis of faith or many doubts, but even that didn't really solve the problem by going to talk to your pastor. Because it sounds like once he was unable to answer your intellectual questions, he's now blaming it on perhaps some sort of sin in your life. Now your conscience is racked with all these issues. What have I done? Where are these doubts coming from? And so all these experiences are sort of feeding into this cognitive dissonance. You mentioned too that you were going through a lot of this stuff alone. Did you ever find other people who were going through similar sort of deconstruction experiences like you were?
And you know, I had also had a few chances by that time to just meet more people who didn't grow up in the bubble and meet more people who were openly queer and that sort of thing. And I think it all contributed, but it really took me till, you know, about 2015 to make a very open break with evangelicalism in a very public way. I published an essay on Religion Dispatches. I published some things there before, but I hadn't been so directly critical of evangelical subculture and hadn't, at least not in a sweeping way. And I hadn't spoken so much about my own experience. And then this particular essay was also picked up by Salon and Alternate, and it caused some real, it was painful for my parents and my sister and some relatives, and I got yelled at. But, you know, it was necessary. I think I almost had to speak out like that publicly in such a way that I wouldn't be able to take it back. Because sometimes in the past, when my mom had broken down crying, I would just say I took everything back.
You know? Right. So you planted the flag.
Because
it's out there now.
I couldn't stand to see my mom cry.
Well, and you hear that a lot in the ex-evangelical community, that their parents who are still in evangelicalism or fundamentalism, when their son or daughter declares, like you did, I am no longer an evangelical, I may no longer even be a Christian, they can be quite cruel and manipulative, trying to get them back into the fold, back into the faith. So this is a common occurrence, isn't it? Is the cognitive dissonance and dealing with the family issues. It's tough, man. It's really tough. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got a fundamentalist sister who's disowned me. And yet, you know, I guess that's her way of getting me back into the fold, is to disown me. So I'm not sure how that's going to work. It's not a good strategy.
Very cruel. yeah. very cruel and abusive type of faith.
And that's
I've been opening up to my dad about more things than my mom because he was safer and always less threatened by difference and always kind of an odd fit for evangelicalism in the first place. But now that we've had to be very open about all of this, I've been able to discover that something that I really did not know as a kid and did not believe, that my parents do love me, despite the differences that I have with them, and they are supportive. And, you know, family does kind of trump ideology for them. They are proud of my accomplishments, and I did not think that they could be, because all our good deeds are as filthy rags, as it's written in Isaiah, you know? Right? So I thought that apart from me believing the exact same things that they did about God, there was no way they could be proud of me.
And as you say,
for some people that plays out, right? You just don't know until you open up.
Yeah.
My parents remain more supportive than many people's parents do.
Yeah. I was going to say it's the exact opposite in so many cases of that ideology trumps family. And so therefore they're willing to disown a son or a daughter totally over the fact that he or she does not believe the same things that they do. And so like my sister, for her ideology absolutely trumps family. She's willing to cut me off and all that. So now I know you mentioned you keep using the word culture wars. I was interested to get into that. I mean, I know we talked before we were recording about sort of the backstory, and I think maybe what I'll do, there's about a 30 minute episode where you go into the real background of the right wing conservatism and how that led to the evangelical support for Trump and all that. So I could point people to that maybe for Patreon supporters. But what would you say is your issue with this sort of authoritarian evangelicalism? Can you kind of summarize that real quickly of what the backstory is there?
Yeah, well, fundamentalism, you know, as a term emerges in the early 20th century. I think it's in 1915 that the Fundamentals, this series of pamphlets that are aimed at liberal theology, attacking liberal theology, higher criticism and that sort of thing, is first released in the series goes on.
Yes, I've done a lot of reading and studying and writing on this very thing too. As you say, the fundamentalists were sort of militant Christians who were really upset and worried that the liberals were destroying the Orthodox Christian faith. So what actually, in your understanding of the term, what actually defines fundamentalism?
Fundamentalism doesn't necessarily have to be defined by people who identify exactly with the fundamentals or who call themselves fundamentalists, though. It's been used as a kind of academic category or a technical term to define certain kinds of religious believers, religious groups, and you can define it sort of sociologically, psychologically. Basically, fundamentalists are anti-democratic. They reject pluralism. They have an authoritarian, paranoid mentality. They need to be able to control things around them in order to feel safe. They insist that they have the one true interpretation of Scripture because they can't handle ambiguity. Most evangelicals at this point in the United States are also fundamentalists, whether they define themselves that way or not. Evangelicalism has become overwhelmingly fundamentalist.
That is absolutely true. In the research and study that I've done, what we find is that the evangelicalism of today is just two or three generations removed from those fundamentalists around the turn of the century. So how do you trace their origins? How far back would you go with it?
The origins of today's white evangelicals, the vast majority of them, the 80% Trump voters, can kind of be found in those who went in that fundamentalist direction. And of course, they're all inextricably tied up with white supremacy and originally the defense of slavery. That's where the Southern Baptist denomination, the largest Protestant denomination in the United States, comes from. It comes from the defense of slavery against other Baptists who didn't think that slaveholders should be able to be missionaries.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, isn't it? When you really trace the roots of it out. But now that's the question.
So where did the Christian right come from?
Yeah.
You know, this whole movement that Jeff Charlotte has studied called the Fellowship or the Family, it was started by a guy named Abraham Baraita, who was working already on this in the 1930s. The 1930s were also a kind of the high point of secularization of the United States. Evangelicals who had been publicly embarrassed by the Scopes trial, they did not retreat, but they were kind of regarded by many people as marginal in their views. What opened up the possibility for them to become mainstream again was the early Cold War for several reasons. You know, one of those reasons was that everyone knows now that you have the atomic bomb, and this raises apocalyptic fears, which religious authoritarian ideas can easily play into.
Oh, yeah.
You also had the founding of modern Israel in 1948, which could be pointed to as evidence of the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, and some people would find plausible. And you had a new rival for the United States on the global stage, primary rival anyway, in the Soviet Union. And communism, the ideology, defined itself as anti-religious and atheistic.
Yeah, secular
state. So you had these concerns, particularly because in the 1930s, too. I mean, there were many so-called fellow travelers who were really kind of interested in what the Soviet Union was doing. And because of the Great Depression, capitalism and democracy itself seemed like a failure. So the Soviet model seemed really attractive to a lot of people, including people who are pretty famous or very famous in American history, people like Helen Keller, for example. So now, after World War II, what do you do to oppose this big idea of communism, which is kind of like trying to achieve the kingdom of God on earth? But people are really moved by this narrative of history and where it can go. You need to have another big idea, and it has to just be bigger than free and fair elections and open markets.
So, right, you put all these pieces together. You have the threat of the Cold War, nuclear annihilation, the founding of modern-day Israel, which a lot of people pointed to as fulfillment of biblical prophecy, and then finally this rise of communism as a competing idea. Out of this context comes this religious right. So how did it all happen? How did it all come together?
A lot of your elites of that day, religious leaders, business leaders, intellectuals, they decided that the best way to oppose communism was to promote religion in the public sphere. And in some cases, that took a more inclusive or quasi-inclusive form, and this is where we get terms like Judeo-Christian, Tri-Faith America. There's a famous book by Will Herbert from the 1950s called Protestant Catholic Jew. Basically, the idea being that, you know, as long as you believe in God, that gives you some way to draw on higher universal values. So that's fine. If you don't believe in God, then you're probably not a good American. But if you can be a Jew or a Catholic or a Protestant and be a good American.
Well, then it sounds like perhaps at first they were willing to be a little bit more ecumenical, at least as far as facing the Russian threat. But what happened over time? Did it remain sort of an ecumenical movement? Were they more concerned about you being a Christian or more concerned about you being an American?
For some people, this really became an idea of a particularly Christian nation, you know, that we needed to be a Christian nation.
Oh, yes, we have to be a Christian nation.
Effectively oppose communism. And so you get this general consensus around the idea that religion needs to be promoted in the public sphere in the early Cold War, which starts to break down around 1960. And what becomes the Christian right really doubles down on the Christian nation thing at that point. Already in the 50s, you've got people like Paul Weyrich working to try to find ways to politicize this kind of faith for hardline conservatism. And then you get certain rallying points in the 1960s. Jerry Falwell Sr. preached against integration and against the Civil Rights Act, for example. So that was one rallying point, but also the removal through a couple of Supreme Court cases, the banning of officially sponsored devotional Bible reading and prayer in public schools became a big rallying point.
Oh, yeah. They've kicked God out of schools. That was a big one, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
They've kicked God out of the schools. And, because he's a gentleman, he just let him do it, I guess. But that's when America started going down the tubes.
We're seeing that kind of ideology rear its head now with all these people talking about, well, we kicked God out of schools, so of course school shootings are allowed to happen now.
Oh, of course. That's
sure,
why.
That's a perfectly normal way to think about that.
So the logic is if we bring prayer back into public schools, the shootings will stop and let God come back in.
You know, there are state-level initiatives now to do things like post In God We Trust, our inane national motto that's also a product of the early Cold War, in public schools. And Tennessee is now requiring that.
It's nothing more than a formula, isn't it? You put that, it's like you put that over the door and God's going to guarantee that there won't be any public shootings. It's just turning the faith into some sort of formula.
It is some pretty ridiculous magical thinking.
It is magical thinking, exactly. All right, so put all the pieces together for us, Chris. How do we arrive at the religious right of today? How did all this happen? Can you put the elements of it together for us?
So, yeah, the the transformation then of these right-wing Christians into a very mobilized force in partisan politics requires several other factors. So you have these kind of rallying points, but you don't yet have the major realignment. It's starting to happen, you know, particularly after the mid-1960s. You have Lyndon Johnson, of course, knew he was going to lose the South by supporting civil rights. So you start to have this partisan realignment, which leads to authoritarian personalities becoming highly, highly concentrated in the Republican Party. You know, and then in the 1970s, in particular after Roe v. Wade, though it takes a while to use abortion as a rallying point, that's a late 70s, early 80s thing. And it's, you know, part of Jerry Falwell's evil genius, I would say, where he realized that he could get Catholics and Protestants to vote together for right-wing Republicans if he could get Protestants to recognize abortion as something that they should rally around.
Yeah, it's a rallying point. And in fact, from what I've read and understood, abortion wasn't even really a topic of controversy among right-wing evangelicals until people like Jerry Falwell came along and, as you say, made it a rallying point, not necessarily because they agreed that it was such a moral problem, although they certainly did. They were more interested, perhaps, in mobilizing both the Protestants and the Catholics alike to elect Republican candidates so they could continue to have their religious freedom upheld.
So they started really kind of building these more effective structures, the Moral Majority, Ralph Reed's Christian Coalition. In the 1970s, the end of fairness doctrine then allows for the rise of things like Fox News. Of course, right-wing Christians already had their own alternative media, but now that becomes more mainstream. And so it's not surprising at all to me that that culminates in support for Trump. Or, you know, you look at what happened with Roy Moore and how we learned when he was running for Jeff Sessions' vacated Senate seat that he had a pattern of pursuing and molesting underage girls when he was in his 30s, and he was even banned from certain shopping malls and things because they knew that he did it. And still, 81% of Alabama's white evangelicals voted for him for senator in that election that he narrowly lost.
And I think I remember hearing that if it wasn't for a very large African-American voter turnout in that particular election, he would have won it. I mean, how can these white evangelicals vote for and support a guy like Roy Moore, a known sexual predator? I mean, how in the world is it that they have this ideology that says we can vote for a guy like him and somehow this is all okay?
He shared that ideology, though. He was removed as Chief Justice of the Alabama State Supreme Court for an ethics violation for the first time because he refused to carry out a court order to have the Ten Commandments monument moved off of state grounds. And at that time, he became a big martyr and hero for these right-wing white evangelicals, and he declared in 2003 that without God there can be no ethics. That's sort of the essence of authoritarian thinking and psychology, that projection. They think everyone is as horrible as they are, and the only possible thing that can keep us from being horrible is submission to authority and fear of punishment.
He was
still horrible, but he thinks that everyone would be even more horrible if they didn't believe in God.
But
it's that old Cold War thinking, and you can trace it back further than the Cold War as well.
I was going to say that same demographic that supported a guy like Roy Moore is the same one that supported a Donald Trump, isn't it? That 81% white evangelical base that he's still pandering to and that still supports Donald Trump. This is the question, I guess, maybe how does the ex-evangelical movement factor into, you've got your own personal deconstruction, your own personal crisis of faith coming out of evangelicalism and seeing the effects of the culture war. What's the threads into even ex-evangelicalism? Because some of it obviously has to do with people's disgust at seeing what that 81% white evangelical base is trying to do and is doing, actually, and how much of it is, I guess, personal, where it's like your own personal story. If you could describe the ex-evangelical thing, I know it's very amorphous. It's not a thing like it's a, you know, it's not a monolith, is it?
No, I mean, it's not entirely monolithic, and it's not something that has top-down leadership structure or anything like that. I would call it a movement, though, as well as a community. And, I mean, politics has been pretty important for the way that it's come together. I mean, I know if you talk to Blake Chastain, who created the Ex-Evangelical podcast, and he talks about his story of deconstruction happening at Indiana Wesleyan University, an evangelical university, it had to do with seeing everybody there pretty much go all in for the Iraq War and being horrified by that. I've seen many people more recently say that, you know, Donald Trump was the last straw for them. And then I've also seen a lot of people, when we have these viral hashtags, trends like Christian alt facts, empty the pews, rapture anxiety, a lot of people saying, oh, I thought I was the only one.
Exactly.
So what is it that's brought us to come together in this moment? I think it is just seeing how far to the extreme that the Christian right will go. And so Trump was a really galvanizing moment for, you know, more ex-evangelicals coming together. And I think how I kind of ended up becoming a prominent voice in all of this was just that I was randomly, well, not randomly, but it seems, I mean, if you just think about the way these things came together, it seems kind of random. I was blowing up on Twitter around the time of the election because I can speak not only to the Christian right, but also to contemporary Russia, both things that were very important to the news cycle. And I can also speak to the connections between those things to the international culture wars, to things like the World Congress of Families that I've written, you know, I published policy research on with political research associates, where right-wing evangelicals and Russians come together to oppose human rights around the world. And so I got a lot of Twitter followers as a result of that, and then was able to start blogging mostly about ex-evangelical issues, and have been able to do some things to help build up the community. And then I was a moderator, admin for the ex-evangelical Facebook group.
I think that's where I got in touch with the ex-evangelical community on the Facebook group, and that's where I met you and Blake Chastain as well. So can you take us through how that group kind of started? What was the genesis of that whole movement?
That group initially existed for former guests and Patreon supporters of the ex-evangelical podcast. But then Blake and I and some others were talking about how we felt like a kind of safe space type group would really be needed for more people. So Blake agreed to open that group up to everybody. I'm not a moderator in the group now. I kind of stepped down from that for reasons of self-care and time. But yeah, I'm still active in the group. It's a great group. It has over 3,000 members now.
So aside from the activity on the ex-evangelical Facebook page, what other kinds of things are happening in this ex-evangelical community? Are they getting together anywhere?
So yeah, things are happening. I mean, and I know also some local gatherings are happening in different places.
Yes.
I'm hoping to get some more events.
We've had two.
I know that Josiah Hesse is a journalist and author who's publishing a sequel to his first novel, Carnality. It's a really interesting, dark, and disturbing read about growing up with radical Christian right ideology in the United States. And it's also kind of a psychological thriller, horror sort of book. He's publishing a sequel. He's going to do a tour for the book launch. I'm going to be part of an event with that in Chicago. I'm sorry, I'm getting a few speaking gigs lined up, and I'm able to get more freelance writing opportunities. And I think, you know, we're going to see things snowballing.
I think so. Yeah, I was going to say we've had two ex-evangelical meetups in Seattle because I've been shuttling back and forth across the pond this summer. And then in September, we're going to be having a live podcast recording on the 16th. And it's going to be, again, that same community, people that I've tapped either on Twitter or in the ex-evangelical Facebook group that are going to be coming out for that. So yeah, there are things happening, as you say, all around the country. And I've tried to do stuff over here in the United Kingdom because I know there are people here in the UK and in Europe that are part of the ex-evangelical group on Facebook as well as Twitter. So at some point, we're going to do something here. I don't know when or why, but or how. I know why. But so you may find yourself coming over here to North Wales. You never know. And being part of an ex-evangelical gathering in the UK. That would be super cool.
I would love to.
Yeah.
Before I left Tampa, we also started planning something like a panel discussion that would then be opened up to the public, you know, to just have a kind of group discussion or Q&A for early September. And we're still hoping to pull that off, and I might be going back for it. So hopefully I'll be making an announcement about that soon. I know Blake has some ideas for things to plan in Chicago. So yeah,
I think we're going to
continue to see increasing ex-evangelical visibility. And I think it is very difficult to separate that from politics. I mean, I know that some people who identify as ex-evangelical mean more libertarian, but I think that most people who do are more liberal or left and very pro-social justice, and that the community is disproportionately women and disproportionately queer people, because those people are, of course, more directly harmed by evangelicalism's hardcore patriarchy than, you know,
definitely.
Straight men are.
It's true. Straight white men for sure. Yeah. We're the majority. I'm the minority here in this group, but I'm one of the few, I guess, but I'm just happy to be part of it.
Yeah. I mean, because of my whole evangelical background, it took me a while. I mean, it took me into my 30s to even figure out that I am queer.
Right.
But once I learned more about gender theory, I was like, oh, hey,
this is me.
That kind of, I think I'm queer. And then, you know, for me, it was initially about gender, but I then had the interesting experience of having a crush on a male friend and realizing that, wow, this can happen to me. You know, I probably just repressed it all before. And I could do that because I am attracted to women, but I was never really comfortable with a lot of things that we associate with masculinity and maleness to the point where we would joke about it.
Yeah,
like,
so other people noticed it too.
Like when I was in high school, like, sure, I love Disney musicals, but I'm comfortable in my masculinity. But all the I'm comfortable in my masculinity part ever meant was I like girls.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think that storyline is so true of a lot of people in the ex-evangelical community that they feel like they're becoming themselves, which is, to me, it's so strange because for years when I was a pastor, I used to say, become the person that God made you to be. And that was my big sort of value statement. But now I think how ironic that it took leaving the church and walking away from all that to become the person or the people that we actually are. It's such a strange thing because the church was supposed to offer all that. But of course, you couldn't. I mean, you could be in certain denominations. You could be queer because there are some more liberal ones for sure. But the more mainline ones, I mean, like you said, homosexuality and abortion are the two main pillars in this culture war, isn't it, in the evangelical or fundamentalist movement. So a lot of people aren't going to fit in there.
Right. I mean, I think that's a pretty profound way that you put that. And I really like that. You know, we have this whole rhetoric of become the person God meant for you to be. And, you know, it's also associated with, in say, the Catholic Church, things like natural law doctrine and their whole concept of human dignity. They fail to recognize that it is prescriptive in a way that harms certain people that just are not able to fit to that definition. And in fact, when it comes to rigid gender distinctions, you know, most people, I think, are going to deviate in some way from what is considered to be a quote unquote ideal type of a man or a woman. And some people have an easier time conforming to that than others. But it's all this cultural conditioning that makes us think that we have to.
Oh, yeah.
And
then you add things
some people just absolutely can't conform.
Yeah.
And there were some things where I just absolutely could not conform and fit in. And it took me a long time to figure out that queerness was a part of that. And the funny thing is that when I finally did figure out that queerness was a part of that, that's when I really became free of fear of hell. I mean, not that it never comes back at all, but it hardly comes back now. And when it comes back, it's just, its emotional impact is minimal relative to what it was before. So I think that like my ongoing crisis of faith that dragged on for so long was doing that because there were deeper issues that I was not getting to. And that was finally, I got to a place where I could start to get to them.
It's amazing how these things are all connected somehow. I was just going to say, how can people get a hold of you? You're all over Twitter probably more than anything else, but if there's anybody out there who actually doesn't follow you on Twitter, how can they find you? What's your Twitter handle? And you mentioned your blog. You want to go through that again and talk about some of your writings, how
sure.
people can read some of the stuff you've written?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, thanks, Matt. Twitter is the easiest way to reach me. I'm pretty responsive there, so if you at me or have open DMs, and I will check my message request. So you can find me on Twitter. My handle is @C_Stroop, Stroop. My blog is called Not Your Mission Field, and it's @ChrisStroop.com. It does have a lot of my own writings and essays, but there are also links. There's a resources page that might, you know, if you're deconstructing or you have deconstructed, but you're looking for things to read that you might find helpful or useful, or that will add some more context. It got a lot of links there on the resources page, which I'm also going to hope to update sometime in the next couple of months. And yes, I've written a fair bit for Religion Dispatches. I haven't yet written for it since it moved to Rewire News, but the old site is still up and is going to be left up. So you can find a lot of my stuff there. I've written 4 articles for Playboy. They are the sort of biggest outlet that lets me be harshly critical of evangelicals in ways that I want to, that I currently, you know, am able to publish in and have a good relationship with an editor there. I know it's somewhat controversial to some people, but anyway.
Oh, yeah. I've read those Playboy articles.
Also writing pieces for Dame Magazine, and my friend Lauren O'Neill and I have a co-edited anthology of essays by former conservative Christians, a very diverse group in terms of gender and race, but it also in sexuality, but it also includes ex-Mormons, ex-Catholics, and ex-evangelicals. That'll be coming out hopefully next year. Current working titles, By the Rivers of Babylon, Apostates Remember Believing. The title could change, but look for more information on that.
Yeah, that's coming up next year. It's funny because going back to your Playboy articles, I think I've read probably all the ones you've written because you post up on different places when you put a new article out. And I always remember my dad, he was a strict fundamentalist, you know, when I was growing up, and he was going to vote for Jimmy Carter, except for the fact that he gave an interview to Playboy magazine. And I can remember my dad making a big deal, like, that's the last straw. I was going to vote for Jimmy Carter. He claimed to be a Christian, but then he went and talked to Playboy. And so that's it. I'm not voting for Jimmy Carter. And he didn't vote for Jimmy Carter. So Playboy magazine, you know, we're only reading it for the articles, not for the pictures, you know, so you're safe because you've only written some stuff for Playboy. But if you ever run for president, you know, a lot of people wouldn't vote for you because you know, associate with Playboy. Pretty funny stuff.
Yeah, I think it's highly, highly unlikely. I think I'm probably unelectable for
for a lot of reasons.
Most national level political offices. But maybe there are some places.
You
like
never know.
For Congress.
You never know. Yeah. You might find yourself on the ballot. Well, listen, Chris, thank you so much. It's been fantastic talking to you. I mean, I can hear all these other conversations that are coming out that I'd love to get into more. I mean, we didn't get into purity culture. We kind of touched on it, but I mean, all these other things that come out of the ex-evangelical movement, things that, you know, people talk about and like you say, are trending in terms of hashtags and stuff. So we have to come back again, if you don't mind. Maybe what I've been trying to suggest to people is to come back in about 6 to 8 months and kind of do a revisit. So if you're up for doing something like that, we could get together maybe around the end of the year and just kind of revisit and see where you're at in terms of how things have changed from now. I know you're in a lot of transition right now, but if you're up for that, that would be cool. Mm-hmm. I would love to do that. We can talk again.
Yeah, I'd definitely be happy to work with you again, Clint. I've enjoyed the chat. So thanks for having me on.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. Take care and I'll speak to you soon.
All right. You too.
You know what I appreciate about talking to Chris Stroup is that he's a guy, as he says, who has the authority basically to speak into some very unique areas. Obviously, he's coming out of evangelicalism, living it, going to church, being raised in it, going to Christian school, living that whole thing of being a missionary and all the rest of it, but also studying things critically as an academic and as a person who's very interested in tracing the effects of religion, evangelicalism, Christianity, as they're trying to win this culture war, not just in America, but all over the world, really. And they think that they have to win the world for God, and that somehow when they do that, I don't know what's going to happen. Is Jesus going to come back, or is that going to be a better utopian society to be like a Christian America, which, of course, is a complete myth anyway? So what's this all about? Well, I hope this episode has helped you to kind of think some of these things through, maybe process through. If it has, I would love to hear from you. I'd love to hear your thoughts, your comments, your feedback, questions, whatever you have for us. You can always get a hold of me on Twitter at MindShift2018 and feel free to send me your questions, your comments, your feedback. If you're one of those rare people who's actually not on Twitter, then you can find me in a variety of other ways, and those connections are always in the show notes, as well as how to follow Chris Stroup on Twitter. And there's a link to his blog as well if you want to check out some of his writings. So you can find those in the show notes. Now, I'm going to say real quick before I let you go, what's coming up in the next couple of weeks? Well, next week and the following week, we have got two episodes. Our Canadian naked pastor friend, David Hayward, I had a great conversation with him not long ago. So we are going to be getting undressed with the naked pastor coming up in the next couple of weeks. I've also got a fantastic conversation with some women coming up. I've got Cindy Wong Brandt. I talked to her. She's all the way from Taiwan. And we're going to be talking about raising children and the effects of religion and evangelicalism on children, as well as her own backstory coming out of evangelicalism. Then I've got another couple of weeks with Dr. Josie McSkimming from Australia. And she's written a fantastic book where she has researched the effects of fundamentalism on people, especially those people who have left it behind and what it's done to them in terms of their own mental health. So a lot of these conversations that I'm having with people like Cindy and Josie and David Hayward and so many others, they are on the effects of religion and how it is so all pervasive and how hard it is to disentangle and deconstruct. So if that's helpful for you at all, then you want to come back and check out the upcoming weeks with Josie, with Cindy, with David Hayward. And also I'm going to slip in there an episode that I did with my sister Valerie Haycock Cunningham. We went back a year later now and we kind of talked about where we're at since our last episode we did last year when she came to visit me here on The Rock, where we talked about surviving a fundamentalist upbringing. What has changed in our lives? Have we gotten better or worse? I don't know. I'm going to have to leave it up to you to check that out. So look for that episode as well. So once again, thanks for joining myself and Chris Stroup here on Mindshift Podcast. I have been your host once again, Dr. Clint Haycock. I'm glad that you came along with us on this journey down that long and winding road.